Hi, everyone. I'm Christina. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Broke Girl Society podcast. I want to give my shout out to Gamban for sponsoring the podcast. If you or somebody you know is struggling with online gambling, please go to their website, gamban.com, and download that software. That will give you a really great start for recovery. That's the beautiful thing about this day and age is we really can build a recovery that works for us. And blocking software being so readily available is an amazing tool. There's also, you know, these podcasts, YouTube show, shout out to the Bet Free Life. There are books and online support groups and online meetings 24/7 at gamblersinrecovery.com. You've got recoveryroadonline.com. You are welcome to join. It's primarily ladies, the Broke Girl Society Facebook group. And then there's Women Gamblers in Recovery on Facebook. It's a new group geared specifically for women. I believe they're going to start up some women preferred meetings. Also, the Broke Girl Society has a Sunday meeting that's women preferred. There are so many Facebook support groups, really. And just reading their stories sometimes helps. Even if you're not ready to tell yours, reading other people's experiences can really kind of help plant that seed and get things moving in the right direction. So, all right, that's enough. That's enough of me preaching to you about recovery. Let's roll on in and listen to Gail's story. She's so wonderful and she's so open about, you know, everything she's been through and helping others. And so it was great to have this conversation with her. I hope you all enjoy this episode. All right, everyone, we are here with Gail, and Gail is here to kind of share her journey of struggles with gambling addiction and recovery. Hi, Gail.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining me. I know it's early your time and I appreciate it.
No worries. Always happy to share my journey.
All right. Well, what I usually do is I just kind of ask my guests to just share, you know, your story, like how it started for you, how gambling started for you, did you know the moment that it became harmful and kind of that journey?
I think I knew probably when it became harmful, because it started taking over a lot of my spare time. I started filling my time with gambling when my now ex-husband was at work. Just to backtrack a bit, I married young, and I knew that my husband his job was going to take him away from home a lot. He was going to be home for 24 to 36 hours and then at work for 24 to 36 hours. And this would continue for a 34-year career. I signed on for that knowing that that's the way it was going to be. But I don't know that I actually really, really realized what I was signing on for. I was signing on for being practically a single mom half the time, being the person that handled everything at home. And with my personality, I'm the type of person that from a very young age was conditioned to try to ensure that everything was okay for everyone. So I wanted to ensure that when he came home from work, everything was okay for him. Everything was handled. There was no issues. Everything was okay. I was the person who handled all the finances. So I tried to make sure everything was okay. Everything was handled. It was all good. And it got to be, after a lot of years, it got to be too much. I was never going to say to him, I want you home more. We had a plan. He was going to be able to retire at 55 years old and be home with a really good pension. And we had a plan. And it was my job to stick to the plan. So I was never going to say that I couldn't do it. Gambling just kind of, I was an online gambler, strictly online. There was no casinos anywhere close to where I live. So online it was. It started as just something to fill time. It didn't start as a money thing or anything. Just something fun to fill the time. And then it got to be an obsessive thing. And then it got to be a money thing. And then it got to be something that was a panic trying to recoup losses, to try to make sure that there was money in the account so that he wouldn't know. And being the person who was 100% responsible for the finances, I just had to make sure that there was money there to cover things. By the time that 19, just I'm a week shy of 19 months in recovery now, and by the time that I told my family about my gambling, which they had no idea about, I think deep down my husband knew, because as soon as I told him about the three mortgages on the house that he thought was paid off and some other debts, he said, is it gambling? Because there had been, you know, gambling things that had come for me in the mail. And he had asked a few times when some financial stuff had come up. He had asked about gambling, and I'd always denied it because, of course, as a compulsive gambler, I was a very good liar, a very good manipulator, very good, you know, could always lie my way out of things. And I think deep down he knew, but he didn't want to know. And so I had used a power of attorney to put three mortgages on the house to cover financial stuff. And when I told him, there was no choice but to tell him, because our house was going to be foreclosed on and we were going to have vehicles repossessed because I could no longer cover anything financial. And everything was coming down around my ears. And I had wanted to tell him long before then, but I was afraid that I was going to lose everything. And I told him and I lost everything. I lost a 33-year marriage. I lost a relationship with my son. I lost a job. I lost my community. I lost my home. I had to move away, start a new life, a complete new life, get a new job, start living on my own for the first time ever in my life. I got a new job, started a new life, got a great job, started a new life, hung by my fingertips some days. I had to do affidavits for court because my husband was fighting the mortgages in court, and I had to do affidavits for court and appear in court. Because of COVID, it was all by phone, but I still had to do that. And if you ever want to a nice little dose of reality in recovery, it's writing down what you did in your active addiction for court and having to appear in court and admit what you did. That's some reality for you. And I didn't actually have charges laid against me of any kind, which I think my higher power was probably looking out for me there, because that didn't happen, hasn't happened yet, thankfully. I have met someone. I have a new relationship. which has been really, really an amazing thing for me, because it's taught me that there is, that there are people who really do forgive past mistakes, and who understand that moving forward is really the only direction to go, and that you know, he's been truly, truly supportive in my recovery. And it's been kind of an ego thing for me to be able to just let go of that ego and admit everything that I did, and be able to admit that as a 57 year adult, I'm lousy with money, and I can handle money and shouldn't handle money. And saying to him, I don't want to deal with any of the money in our relationship. And to admit to him everything that I did financially, how I did it, how I managed it, how I was able to do the things I did, and tell him how we needed to put up safeguards so that I would not be able to do the things I was able to do, and how we needed to protect ourselves financially from me should I fall off the rails, was really putting aside my ego and really being an adult and saying, what I need to do is I need to sign over my paychecks to you, and I need to not have a bank account that I can't show income in, because if I can show income and if I need money or feel I need money, I will get payday loans. I will get loans. I will have access to these things. And the best thing for us is for me not to have that ability. And that way I know that should something go really, really wrong in my recovery, I don't have that ability. And just being able to be really super honest and without judgment, that was the thing. Be able to be super honest without any judgment, and just be able to just take those steps and put up those boundaries and put up those fences. And I have one credit card with a low limit that is what I use. And I know what our finances are. We've paid off my debt. I have a pension that goes right toward my debt, and it's all been taken care of. I know what our finances are all the time, but I don't have to worry. I just sign over my checks and it's taken care of. I don't have that stress, and it has been such a relief to me to not have to stress. We had a pipe burst in the house at one point, and I knew about it when I was at work, and I started to get anxiety because I thought, how are we going to pay for that? What are we going to do? How are we going to pay for that? And I felt that panic, that anxiety, like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to do something. I'm going to have to do something. And I walked in the house and I handed him the credit card because I didn't know what I would do. And I said, you need to hold on to this till morning until I process all this. And there was no questions, no, nothing. He just held on to it. And I said, I just need to figure out how to process this panic, because a year ago, I would have been figuring out how to gamble so that I could try to get money to be able to think, we need to fix this. But he just very calmly said, we've got the money to do it. It's fine. You don't need to do anything. This is not something you need to fix. It's not something you need to do. It's looked after. It's fine. Just, process it. It's okay. And, when I was ready to get the card back, I just asked for it back. It was all good. But no judgment. No questions, no judgment, just acceptance. And it's just so wonderful to be able to move forward and not have to keep looking back. And it's been so helpful in my journey of forgiving myself for what I did, because my narrative that has come from my ex-husband has been that I am the one that ruined our family and ruined his life. Where, you know, I have to, in a lot of ways, wonder how much he suspected and just didn't question. You know, I mean, I'm sure that some of my lies were pretty unbelievable at times. You know, when the bank was having issues with our bank cards for like 5 days at a time because I was panicked because there was no money in the account and he couldn't use the bank card. How often does that happen? And, you know, he could have gone to the bank and found out, and he just didn't want to know. You know, I wonder, but it's, I mean, I can't bring myself to blame anyone else for a part in it. I did what I did. I did the things I did in my active addiction. And I've taken responsibility. I've accepted everything that I did. But I won't accept the narrative of, I just won't accept his narrative of being someone who ruined a family and ruined his life, because he has, you know, he has the ability to pick up his own pieces just like I've picked up mine.
Yeah, I relate to a lot of the things you've said, especially that, I mean, so many, because I was the same way with my partner, my husband. I handled all the finances. I told the same lies when things wouldn't work, to my family and friends. And it's just like, at some point you're like, why did you believe that? Because it makes absolutely no sense. I remember my mom saying, you should have won an Oscar for all the acting and lying that you did. And it's like, we knew you were lying. It was just getting so far-fetched, you know, but, and it does often make you wonder, like, why didn't somebody say anything, or why didn't they call you out? But at the same time, it's like, I think I've just come to understand it's because they love us, one, and they don't know what to say, two, and they know probably at that point we wouldn't accept anything they said anyway. We'd probably still try and lie our way out of it, right? Because we're in that, like, gotta make them believe us, the mind frame. At least for me, that's the case. I know with my mom, she's like, I was just so scared if I said anything to you that you wouldn't ever talk to me again. And that scared me more than what you were doing. And that kind of thing. But my husband was very much the same way. It was like, why didn't he ask? Why didn't he dig? Why didn't he, you know, we both make a very good living. Why didn't he question why we were always broke? I took it, you know, we still have a really hard time talking about it. Cause he's very much of the mindset, like, it's done, you know, like, we can't go back and change it. He's not great for the conversation about it. But I think it's a lot of times too, cause they don't want to, right? Then he didn't want the responsibility of the finances either.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, I mean, we definitely have to own our part in it for sure. And just kind of try and figure out and understand their part,
right,
too. And another thing too, it's the chaos, right? Like for me, it's car trouble. Car trouble will send me into a tailspin. And because I'll start to panic, because most of the time when we're in active addiction, our bank accounts are on E. So if anything major comes up, it is like, oh my God, I've told every lie I could to get money to gamble. How am I going to tell a lie to get money to actually fix the problem I'm having? Because I've probably already said this before to get money just to gamble. And now there's actually an issue and I've got to figure out a way to pay for it. And so, you know, a few months back I had car trouble and I had the same exact experience, Gail. I was like, oh my gosh, how am I going to, I can't handle this. How am I going to do this? And then it was like, oh wait, I haven't gambled in months. I actually can afford to take care of this.
Yeah.
So yes, I very much relate to that experience. So how did recovery start for you?
Recovery started for me by one day just realizing that there was no choice. The house was going into foreclosure. Vehicles were going to be repossessed, and I could not hide things anymore. There was just no possible way I could hide things. So I had to tell my husband, and when I told him that the house that he thought was paid off and that we were going to be able to sell and move somewhere to retire, he started to cry, and I think I actually heard his heart break. He left the next morning and went to our son's for 10 days. And during that 10 days, they asked for lots of documents from me to try to figure out how bad it was. I was left at home on my own, just the dog and I, and, I had to try to remember. And I think anybody that's been in that situation, you know, I didn't actually remember, the answers to a lot of the questions that they had for me. I didn't remember all the details, all the loans, all the everything, all the payday loans, everything. I couldn't remember everything because things get done in such a panicked state sometimes to try to come up with funds that I didn't remember absolutely everything. But I had promised that I was never going to place another bet and that I was never going to tell another lie. So I was trying my very best to keep to both those promises. I was also, at that point trying to, figure out if my life insurance policy would pay out, if I could make a suicide look like an accident. And I sat on that for about 36 to 48 hours. And I think, the thing that made that decision for me was really our next door neighbor and friend had committed suicide, 2 months prior to that. And, he had done it at home. He had shot himself on the back deck, and we were home when he did it. And we had been through that trauma, and we had lived through that trauma of calling 911 and being through that and living through that with the family. And having lived through that and been through that, I can honestly say that that's probably what kept me alive, was having been through that and knowing firsthand what my family would go through. So I chose recovery, and I started searching online for how to do it and what I needed to do. My dad had been in AA when I was younger, when I was a teenager. So I knew there had to be a 12-step program. So I started searching, and I started going to Zoom meetings right away. And I didn't look back. I kept that promise of not telling another lie and not placing another bet. And I'm 6 days away from 19 months.
Congratulations on 19 months. Now, I don't think I asked you in the beginning, were you an online gambler or a brick and mortar gambler?
I was online. There was no casinos anywhere close to me until I moved away. Once I moved, then there is a casino actually in the same town where I work. But as soon as the casinos opened up, I self-excluded immediately. I was quite sure that my anxiety of being around a bunch of people that I don't know would keep me from going in. But I wanted to, just like having Gamban on my phone, I've never actually tried gambling on my phone again since I went into recovery. But it's one of those things that just makes me feel comforted knowing it's there. The self-exclusion is just one of those things that is like a picket in my fence. It just is one of those things that makes me feel comforted knowing that it's there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I have never gambled online. It's not legal in my state. And I know there's probably black sites or something that you can do, but I don't know anything about that. But I do have Gamban on my phone and computer for those exact reasons, as just another barrier in case because I know when I first stopped gambling, somebody sent me to try and explain to me these YouTube slot players where they record what they're doing. And I remember watching that and it was kind of triggering for me. And I was just like, okay, no. And then once I became familiar with Gamban, I thought, I'm going to download this because, you know, with the way that online gambling, sports betting and everything is just like growing and spreading, like, I just don't want there to be that little window that allows me to do that. So, you know, good for you for thinking of that. And even if it's not something you've done before to strengthen your recovery, I think anything we can do, what kind of things do you do now that help in recovery?
I attend meetings. I get up at crazy enough, what I call my home GA group is, so I live in British Columbia, Canada, and my home GA group is in Georgia. Crazy enough, because I'm a Zoom meeting baby. I've never been to where I am. There's no live GA meetings. And so I came into recovery into Zoom meetings because I came in during the pandemic. And my home group is actually in Georgia. These people have helped me through some of the worst times in my life. And so they're 3 hours ahead of me. So their Saturday morning meeting is at 9:30 Saturday morning. So that's 3 hours ahead of me. So I set my alarm and get up at 6:15 on Saturday mornings on a sleep-in morning and go to my meeting with bedhead and coffee, great big mug of coffee and go and have a meeting with my family on Saturday mornings. And then my shift has changed and I can go every second Monday at 4 o'clock in the afternoons now too. I go to meetings on Recovery Road online when I can. I used to chair meetings, but with work, it just doesn't work anymore. It's too hard because I commute for work. I read whatever literature I can. I reach out daily. I have a recovery partner who is exactly 30 days ahead of me in recovery. And we text each other daily. And we have made a pledge that that 30 days is never going to change. And we keep each other accountable. We met in a meeting when I joined recovery and realized that he was 30 days ahead of me. And we just bonded very quickly. And it's just that, you know, that 30 days, that exactly 30 days is just something really special. And we just keep each other accountable. And we just reach out, you know, whenever life gets too lifey.
Yeah.
You know, because that happens, right? Life just gets lifey, whether it be, you know, something with work or home or, you know, because some days like living life on life's terms is just too much.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's the thing with recovery, right? We're not guaranteed a perfect life. Life is still going to be life.
Yeah, it is. And we just, you know, we always dove into that escape that we had, that escape of gambling, and, you know, you dive into that world and just escape whatever was going on and put everything aside and say, oh, well, I'll just go back to all that later and worry about it later. And we just can't do that anymore because we know where that took us. So you have to go through life as it comes at you. And sometimes you just need somebody that gets it.
Absolutely.
To talk to.
Yeah. Connection is something that anybody who has listened to me long enough knows that is what I preach. Out of anything you can do, it's just connect with somebody who knows exactly where this addiction is taking you, where it can take you again if you aren't being mindful of your life.
Absolutely. And that's what I've always tried to tell people when they first come in recovery is, you know, they always say, oh, well, you know, I didn't reach out before I went back, you know, because it was just too hard to say that, you know, that I was going to fail or that I felt like I was going to fail. And I've always tried to encourage people to, you know, reach out when things are good, you know, come up with somebody or two or three people that you connect with and reach out and talk to them every day. You know, just a text, hey, you know, how's it going today? Or, you know, what's your weather like today? It's really sunny here. Or just reach out and talk and connect every day when things are good, and do it when things are good. Because then if you're having a really crappy day, it's easy when it's crappy. And it's not like you're picking up a 1,000-pound phone to do it when it's crappy, because you're talking to this person or these people every day anyway. So it's not so hard. Do it when it's good, and then it's easy when it's bad.
Yeah, that's great advice. Because you know what a lot of people, myself included, have said, when you start thinking about gambling because you're having that really bad day and those thoughts of gambling come into your, you know, a lot of times you convince yourself that you're going to gamble and you just don't even think about the phone list or your contacts or anything like that. But if you're, and that's usually after not staying in contact or not staying connected. And so if you stay connected and you have those conversations every day, then it's like, if those thoughts do pop up, it's like, I mean, I haven't really had a whole lot of urges except for around the holidays, but I was so connected, you know, with the Broke Girl Society Facebook group, support group, and just everybody that's in my life, that I was having so many conversations per day that if it fluttered in my head, it fluttered right back out, you know, because I was talking to somebody who just understood. And I was having all these conversations. And so it was easier just to keep me on track. And so it's like a lot of people were like, I don't want to reach out because I don't want to burden anybody. And that's just not going to be the case. It really isn't.
No, and what I've found is if you're talking to somebody a lot and they really get you and you're talking to somebody a lot, it's so hard to isolate yourself to where you're having those thoughts and isolating yourself away, because if they don't hear from you and you're talking to them all the time and reaching out and chatting with them every day, if they don't hear from you for a day, they're going to reach out to you and say, "Hey, what's happening? What's going on?" And you're not going to get that chance to isolate yourself, because you're talking to them every day and you don't get that chance to isolate and have those bad thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. When you were chairing meetings for RRO, how did that feel being kind of early recovery chairing meetings? Did you feel like it really benefited and helped solidify your recovery? Or was it more pressure?
No, I so my recovery partner and I, that was 30 days apart, we chaired them together, and we took a little bit of a different approach to meetings. We didn't have a heavy themed type meeting. We took a really different approach. We would have a recovery game. We took an approach that recovery can be fun, and that recovery doesn't have to have this really heavy kind of theme to it. And so we would play games. We would have recovery squares where you got to take turns asking a question about recovery to someone else in the room, and then they would get to go on and ask someone else. Everybody really liked that. We would play recovery alphabet, where the chair would we'd go through the alphabet, and when it was your turn, you. If it was A, you picked a word to do with recovery that started with that letter of the alphabet, and you shared what that word meant to your recovery. Everybody really liked that. We had a few different games that we played, and people really liked the approach that recovery didn't have to be really serious. We had a lot of fun in our meetings, and we drew quite a crowd. And people really liked that it was light. And I, you know what? Sometimes there was tears, followed by a lot of laughter, and it was we didn't find that there was pressure. We found that there was a lot of fun, and that it could be light, and that people liked that there could be laughter in recovery, and that it yeah, just that there could be laughter in recovery, and it was okay to laugh in recovery. It was okay to have fun with it, that you didn't have to always feel sad and remorseful.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think, you know, when you first walk into a meeting, you're so heavy, you're so devastated. Everything about your circumstances or situation can be really, really difficult. And you walk into a recovery meeting and they're life changing, and they can be life changing in different aspects. You can walk into one, and like for me, the very first meeting I did was an in-person GA meeting. And well, it's the second meeting. The first I did was a Zoom meeting, but I crashed it, so I don't really count it. But the real first meeting was an in-person GA meeting. And hearing the stories of those people who were just like me, who thought just like me, who had, done some of the same, that changed my life. But at the end of it, they were kind of lighthearted and laughing, and it just kind of gave me this hope, like eventually I can feel that too. I wasn't feeling it right then, and I think some people kind of get like maybe offended a little bit when they're so downtrodden, and they go in and people are laughing, they're like, "I'm hurting, like this isn't funny at all." But I would think it would give somebody hope. Like, I will be able to smile again. I will be able to laugh again. And And the number one thing is meetings aren't a life sentence of just meetings and sadness. It's family, it's connection, it's growing, it's healing, it's so many things. So, you know, the meetings that I have been, I've played the ABC game, I've played some different games, and they are some of the best meetings because you get to know more about the people you're in, especially in this world of Zoom, right? Where we're, yes. That's been my, pretty much most of my recovery time too, because I'm just over a year. So that's been a majority of my recovery time too. And the podcast world and things like that. So it is really great when there is laughter, because that's like one of the most healing things, right?
It is. And you know, what gave us the idea was my very first meeting ever. I cried through my very first meeting. And the second, my second meeting was the RRO birthday meeting, where they, you know, they give out the certificates and acknowledge milestones. And I remember, you know, I remember people, you know, laughing and congratulating and clapping and acknowledging these milestones. And I remember thinking, wow, you know, these people are happy and they're, you know, they're laughing and they're crying and they're, you know, but it was happy tears. And I remember being, you know, a few hours into my recovery, literally a few hours in, and thinking, I want that. I want that feeling of being free of this and being able to smile and being able to cry those happy tears that I'm feeling better. And and that's actually what gave us the idea of doing our meetings that way. And, you know, letting people know that it can be that way. That it doesn't always have to be that feeling of weight and misery and regret. That there's lots of time for that, but you can take an hour out and have some fun with some friends.
It's very much about balance through it all, right? Reflection, you know. And there's a certain amount of remembrance that we have to deal with so that we know what keeps us going forward. And it's very much just the balance of it all, just like life, everything in life, you know? So as we kind of go to wind it down, how are you today? Almost 19 months in recovery. How do you feel like life is for you right now?
Life is still some days a struggle. I wish my son understood addiction. My son is a very good, my son's a very good businessman. Everything is very black and white to him. In his mind, everything that I did was a very calculated decision. I don't know whether he will ever understand addiction. I hope that one day he does, because I miss my son very much. It breaks my heart that I have lost my relationship with my son. He is my youngest, and he is the one of my two children that I was always the closest to. And it breaks my heart, but I need to give him his space, and I need to accept that I can't change anything to do with that. I just need to accept it as it is and wait it out. So that still creeps up on me sometimes, that's really hard. I feel strong most days. Moving forward in a new relationship has its challenges too. You know, my kids are older. I had my kids very early in life. My kids are, you know, 38 and 33, and I'm in a new relationship where he had his kids later in life. So I'm helping raise two teenage girls half time now. So it's not without its challenges again, but I am so blessed, I think, in my new relationship that I have a partner who is so accepting of my addiction and is so supportive of moving forward and leaving the past behind, and so supportive of things that I have needed to do, including, you know, the amazing thing of I bought a car after I had to separate from my husband. I bought a car, and it was at a time when I was going through the worst of my recovery, and I was going through some terribly dark, hard days. Terribly hard, dark days. And every time I got into that car, I could hear my ex-husband's voice telling me the horrible things I had done and what a terrible position I had left him in. And I hated that car. I just hated it. And I finally told my new partner about that not long ago. And he bought me a new car, so I didn't have to listen to that anymore. And like, to me, the things that he has done to enable me to move forward freely and to be able to leave my past behind and to be able to move forward in a new way is amazing to me. And the support that he shows for me and my recovery is just the most amazing thing. And I feel completely and totally supported. And there are tough days. There are still tough days. There are still things that trigger me and cause me anxiety for weird reasons. But I know that I have support, and I know that I can reach out, and I know that that it's going to take something really big for me to go back. Because I have so many things in place, and I have so many pickets in that fence between myself and gambling, that, you know, there might be something that might cause me to falter a bit in life, but I think it would take something really huge for me to go back and really do something big, because I just don't ever want to go back there again.
Agreed. I don't either. I don't ever want to go back to that life again. Thank you so much, Gail, for coming on, for sharing your story, for being vulnerable. I appreciate you so much. And I look forward to continuing recovery with you. As a sister in recovery.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Christina.
All right. Thank you.